You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Webber Davis, in for April Baer.
Detroit has several billionaires who influence the way the city looks and feels. Among them, Martha Ford, who married into the Ford Motor Company family and is owner of the Detroit Lions. Mattie Maroon, who owns the Ambassador Bridge and recently sold the old train station in Detroit to Ford. The Ilitches, who own the Detroit Tigers and the Red Wings and Motor City Casino and, of course, Little Caesars Pizza. And then there's Dan Gilbert, a newer but phenomenally important name in the landscape of billionaires who invest in the city. He founded Quicken Loans and has since transformed the core of Detroit's downtown. This group of people has profound reach in the city. They pour out into the community with their philanthropic investment, and they stretch up into the sky with ownership of some of Detroit's most significant buildings and infrastructure. So how does a city balance the needs of its investors with the needs of its communities, especially when those needs might be at cross purposes? Here to help me unpack the influence of the very wealthy on the city of Detroit is Brandon Snyder, Executive Director of Detroit Action. Brandon, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
And we have Robin Boyle. He's a retired professor of urban planning at Wayne State University. Robin, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Anne. Good afternoon.
So let's start with you, Robin. How do the super wealthy factor into Detroit's modern development strategy?
Well, like any other city on the globe, billionaires like to play in this particular sandcastle. Just think of Monopoly. When you go and play the game, you're after the big bucks and you're after the big property. Cities and wealth go hand in hand. It's a complicated partnership, but it's very much part of the way that cities evolved, particularly in the last 150 years or so. Since about the 1860s, we've seen significant agglomeration of capital focusing on cities where they see, the billionaires, the wealthy, see opportunity to expand their wealth. It goes very much with the territory. Here in Detroit, you've identified a number of billionaires that are active in cities. That is not unfamiliar. Around the world, around the rest of the United States, the billionaires have a very important part to play. What makes Detroit distinctive, and something I'm sure we will come back to discuss, is the extent to which really two, maybe three, maybe four, if you stretch it, players who do command rankings on the Forbes lists of the wealthiest people in the nation have had a huge impact in the past, decade. I mean, it's that short a time.
Well, let's talk, Brandon, about where we see tangible investment, things that we can see with our eyeballs. I'm thinking of the Q Line, of course, through Dan Gilbert's Bedrock, LCA and the District Detroit with the Ilitches. Let's talk about how they've changed the visual landscape.
Yeah, you know, I guess in the last 10 years or so, you know, maybe even shorter than that, the last 8 years, you know, we've seen this massive change in this landscape of downtown from, some of those landmarks that you've mentioned. And, you know, what's happened is that, you know, in addition to one of the things that Robin has mentioned, is that this massive, changing or a massive accumulation of capital, you know, we've also seen a massive accumulation of power, be it political power and be it, economic power from those who've developed downtown. Dan Gilbert, who you mentioned, is a property owner of some 80 some properties downtown. And this has happened just within the last 8 years, where if you were to post housing bubble, post bankruptcy of the city of Detroit. So I think that when we look at, the role of billionaires and we look at, how the influence that they've made in downtown, you can't sort of separate the amassing of capital and the amassing of property with the accumulation of political power.
Well, I want to talk about the benefits and concerns that we're dealing with here. Let's start with the benefits. Robin, what are some of the benefits that we have when we have billionaires investing in cities?
Well, the obvious benefit and one that I would say Dan Gilbert and his family of companies have provided are jobs. Let me just give you one specific example. 10 years ago, the largest employers in the city of Detroit, and I mean the 139 square miles, the largest employers were, and this is not in any particular order, General Motors, the public schools, the city, and the state. Today, the largest employer in the city of Detroit is Gilbert and his family. Around 18,000 people are employed, much, much more than any of the previous employers that I have just mentioned. Because the car industry, as you know, has been in decline. Ford is not headquartered here. FAC is outside, and they don't have a great deal of construction. So first and foremost, large-scale investment, whether they're millionaires or mere, you know, if they're billionaires or mere millionaires.
mere millionaires.
Right. The most important impact in the short term is the fact that they bring jobs into the city. And in that downtown area, that 7.2, that little area that we talk about at downtown, these jobs have made an incredible difference.
But I would say that out of that, then the concern is probably who they're employing. Am I right, Brandon?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that you look at when you talk about the jobs that people that have been employed by the Bedrock family of businesses is that many of those jobs, you know, came from the suburbs and were relocated downtown. Many of the folks who are employed are, you know, traditionally much more wealthier, much more college educated, much more white than the city as a whole. And what we see is that, you know, people that like we represent, folks who are, you know, native Detroiters, people who are black and brown, people who, you know, are lower income, you know, and many of the folks, specifically people who have felony backgrounds, you know, aren't employed into the Bedrock family of businesses. And so what we have is, you know, while we have this development and this creation of jobs, what we have is, you know, this development that's sort of unequal and tenuous at best.
Well, let me push back on that a little bit.
Please.
If I could. I think Brandon is correct. The majority of full-time employees who are coming in under the banner of the billionaires tend to be either people who have come in from the jobs in the suburbs, because he moved his company in 2010 from Livonia, or they are newcomers who have come into the city filling the positions in some of these quite unusual jobs, StockX, for example, who are attracting people from around the country. But let me push back a bit. If you go down into Campus Martius today and look at what happens at lunchtime, you see thousands of young African-Americans pouring out of these buildings. Why? Because Dan Gilbert has one of the largest internship programs in the country dedicated to bringing jobs to young kids for the summer. Now, you say, okay, it's an internship. Does it add up to something? Well, hell yes, it does. It adds up to people giving a chance to get a job in a downtown firm, a chance to perhaps see the opportunities, perhaps to give them a motive, whether you're black, white, or indifferent, to stay in school, to finish, and to become one of these employees downtown. So while I agree with the fact that a lot of the folks filling the buildings 365 days a year tend to be white, this impact in the summer and the internship programs is not to be dismissed. I think Gilbert has committed to that and has done it now for something like 5 years.
Yeah, but if I may, I think that the internship program represents just a small minority of the whole employees who are at the you know, Bedrock family of businesses.
Yes.
What you see is, you know, for people who are, you know, black and who are employed and who are lower income, you know, many of these people make up the positions that are, you know, your people who are in the kitchens, people who are the janitors, people who are the security guards. And what we end up seeing is that, you know, the businesses that employ those folks who are employed by those buildings, you know, don't pay their folks a living wage. So we end up having, again, you know, a really tenuous process of job creation where we're giving away taxes and benefits to corporations who ultimately, you know, trickle down, you know, low paying jobs for local Detroiters. And I think that's one of the things that we look at when we talk about development that's very unequal, you know, very unfair to the folks who are ultimately paying for this development to occur.
If you're just joining us now, I'm Laura Weber Davis, and joining me is Brandon Snyder. He's Executive Director of Detroit Action, and Robin Boyle, Professor of Urban Planning, recently retired from Wayne State University. If we can continue on this line a bit, I'm curious, when you have very few wealthy white people making decisions for a city that is populated by hundreds of thousands of black people, and particularly in a city that has a poverty rate that's as high as it is, are there ways that these investors and the city can be avoiding turning that unbalance into further racial inequity?
I mean, I think one of the easiest ways is, you know, the community benefits agreement process. You know, I think that that is a process that
If we can just recap that quickly for our listeners, the community benefits agreement would ostensibly require investors to hire a certain number of Detroiters and locals for their projects.
I think that's one of the processes, but there's also many other agreements that come with community benefits. You know, when the Pistons moved to Detroit and Henry Ford Hospital was being developed, one of the things that they created as an externality was, you know, that we would create basketball hoops and fix up local parks. So there are a number of ways that corporations can work with communities, you know, if they're going to receive tax benefits and tax breaks to move and to develop. One of the things that we believe, you know, is important if, you know, for corporations like the Bedrock family to, you know, if they're going to move to town is, again, to hire folks who, you know, who are from our community. And, you know, to work around historic preservation. So groups like Detroit People's Platform, groups like ours and other community groups have really been pushing to make sure that, you know, the Bedrock family of companies, Chrysler, as well as other folks who are moving into town, you know, really work with surrounding neighborhoods to ensure that the quality of life doesn't change dramatically, but also that people who are in the city are able to be employed because of this changing in development. And I think that's one of the things that we're most interested in. When we talk about development for downtown, is that, you know, yearly we have about 5,000 Detroiters who come home from prison throughout the state to Wayne County, and zero of those folks can actually get employed from the Bedrock families.
I mean, I think I agree with almost everything that's been said, and it is important that when companies, particularly companies that get state or local incentives, there needs to be, and in the case of the city of Detroit, there is a requirement that employment is dedicated towards those who live in the city of Detroit. There's a problem, and we know what the problem is, and this is what the pushback is from so many of the companies, is that the skill levels are not there because the building trades, the construction trades, the welders, the scaffolders, the millwright workers, et cetera, are people who come out of skilled trades. Many of the folks in big cities, not least Detroit, lack these skills. So there has to be a similar public policy platform built to actually improve the training opportunities that there are in the city. And we failed to do that over the years. We've simply failed to do it. So now the companies can turn around and say, but we can't get people who work with stone. We can't get people who work with wood. We can't get people who work with steel. We have to go outside. And it's very hard to argue against that if you don't have a pool of skilled trades in the city.
But should the wealthiest investors in the city of Detroit be required to be on the hook for some of that training?
Yes, absolutely. That is what they should be doing. They should be investing in this world. We have reduced the capacity of the public sector in so many fields, not least in skilled trades training. That it is behooven to these companies to step up and be much, much more involved in supporting and working directly with community colleges, with other organizations to build a much deeper, much thicker layer of skilled folks who live and work in the city of Detroit.
Agreed. And I think the other thing that to add to that is that many of the labor unions who service these properties or are hired to develop these properties are people who, you know, oftentimes invest in that sort of skills development and skills training, especially at IBEW and other folks who are labor unions here. One of the things that I think that's important to note is that, you know, by investing and allowing people to be a part of unions, be a part of the and be a part of the labor force, you know, there is an opportunity to develop skills, but also an opportunity to reduce turnover because people who are a part of unions, people who are part of who are well trained by unions, you know, often stick with the job and often are able to accomplish that job much more effectively.
Robin, I'm curious if Detroit is in some ways particularly vulnerable to being molded by a few moneyed parties because Detroit has sort of seen this surge in recent years and has seen a lot of devastation over the past 50, 60 years.
Yes and no. I think, let me answer that in a slightly complicated way, and I'll try and keep it quick. A few months ago, I used a social media platform that I'm involved with through work to ask a similar question. To what extent has your city, these are our colleagues who work across the United States of America and Canada, to what extent in your city can you identify the proportion of development occurring similar to that in Detroit? In other words, are you being dominated by particularly very wealthy individuals? And with really just one exception, maybe two, no other place was demonstrating the same sort of impact that the one family, in this case, of course, Dan Gilbert and his range of companies, was having. The other place was Durham, North Carolina, funnily enough. And the other one, and it's a bit of a stretch, is in the Northwest, where in Seattle, there's been incredible investment by a relatively small number of very, very wealthy people coming out, of course, of the high-tech economy. So yes, in answer to your question, I think a place like Detroit is to some extent vulnerable. But on the other hand, that vulnerability was caused by the exodus of wealth. That vulnerability was caused by those who did own property, who did nothing, sat on their properties, not investing in them, letting them fall apart, or worse still, getting knocked down and becoming car parks, that there was an opportunity for an individual like Gilbert to come in and buy properties at 15 cents on the dollar and then become this really, really large real estate owner here in the city of Detroit. And that then in itself leads, of course, to the problems and the concerns that perhaps we've already discussed.
That was Robin Boyle, a retired professor of urban planning at Wayne State University. We also were speaking with Brandon Snyder, executive director of Good Jobs Now.